Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome to Bina. I do see a few new faces, so welcome if you haven't been here before. If you're not on our email list yet, see me afterwards and I'll add you on. For those who don't know, Bina is all about adult Jewish education. That's what we're about. We have a very, very diverse program. We have different streams. We have a Medrash stream with advanced Torah learning. We have Bina Living, all about personal growth. And this series, which is Rabbi Meets Expert, is in the Bina Core stream, which includes the Jewish view to different things in the world and different topics. So tonight, please come in, there's plenty of seats at the front. Tonight we're here to discuss quite a painful topic, a very painful topic, of dementia. And we're going to hear from a rabbi and an expert, sort of the Jewish view and just all about the topic of dementia. It's a very painful topic. It's personal to me as well. There is a member of my extended family who suffers from dementia. Every family almost has someone who suffers from this illness, and it's very, very painful. But in general, information is a good thing. In general, to be informed about something is a very good thing. And especially as Jews, to be informed on it on a Jewish level. What does Torah have to say about it? Because Torah has, and Judaism has, what to say about everything. And specifically the tough things and the painful things is where we turn to most. Our Torah and our guide as inspiration, as where to go in these very, very dark places. So what we're going to do, we're going to hear from our expert tonight, who's Tamar Krebs. And then we'll hear from my father, Rabbi Gerari, who's going to give us the Jewish perspective. So, and then we'll have some questions, and then we'll open it up to the crowd if everyone has some questions of their own. So, Tamar, thank you very much for coming almost internationally from the North Shore. Thank you very much. Tamar is the founder and CEO of Group Homes Australia. She founded it in 2009. Tamar has worked in the aged care industry for the past 15 years, both internationally and here in Australia. She holds many relevant and necessary qualifications, such as a Master's of Health Service Management, a Bachelor of Science, and various certificates and diplomas in which provides her knowledge in gerontology. So we're very happy to have you here. Thank you so much for coming, and welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. What I'd like to do over the next 25 minutes is to share with you the world of dementia. The word suffering was mentioned a few times in the introduction, so I want to try and help you shift the mindset that it's about living with dementia and not necessarily suffering with dementia. And yes, dementia is a very scary topic, and people don't like to necessarily talk about it or discuss it or confront it. But I want us to, what I hope to achieve in the next 25 minutes is to give you a bit of a mind shift. And I'm happy to take questions at the end, so feel free. So the first thing, what is dementia? We use the term very loosely, and we hear about it in the news. We all know someone with dementia, or we know someone in our family that had dementia. So what is it? And often people say, oh, my mom has Alzheimer's, but she doesn't have dementia. Or my friend has dementia, but they don't have Alzheimer's. So there's this confusion around what is the term, what does it mean? So I want to give you an analogy of an umbrella like a car. Okay, so if we put the car and we put the word Toyota. So the word dementia is an umbrella term to describe a whole area of diseases. So you have Toyota, Holden, Lexus, Ferrari. Those are all different types of cars. You have the word dementia, and you have Alzheimer's, Lewy bodies, vascular dementia, and another 97 different types of dementia. Okay, so there are over 100 different types of dementia. The most common type of dementia is Alzheimer's. Anywhere between 60 to 70% of people diagnosed with dementia have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's. So when people say, my mom has Alzheimer's but doesn't have dementia, the chances are she probably does have dementia. Okay, so dementia is a lot of different symptoms. So who gets dementia? So when we were younger, we used to know people that were, they used the term evil-bottled, or people that were confused, or people that were just, they got old. So first and foremost, which is very, very important, dementia is not a normal part of aging, okay? Not every person sitting in the room is going to get dementia just because they get old. However, the older you get, the higher the risk. And so the longer we're living, the higher the risk that we get dementia. So people think longevity is great. You could challenge that and say you're going to live longer, but you're going to live with more chances of getting different types of disease. Dementia is a disease that you definitely see in younger people. So the youngest person that I've ever seen with dementia was a 29-year-old, and that was in nursing school in Jerusalem. And initially they diagnosed him with schizophrenia, bipolar, depression. They went through all these different mental illnesses. And at the end, when they couldn't confirm a diagnosis, they finished with dementia. And how do you diagnose a 29-year-old? And the youngest person I've seen here in Australia is 45. So dementia is not an old person's disease. You can get it at a young age. And so it's not a normal part of aging. So the questions are, what are the signs of dementia? And often people come to me and say, before they get a diagnosis, they usually start having conversations. I'm noticing something strange with my mom, my dad, my partner. Unfortunately, sometimes it's my child. If it's an older parent coming to have a chat, they're noticing something strange. So you usually ask them, well, what are the strange things that you're noticing? They're becoming a bit repetitive. Okay, we all repeat ourselves, right? They're losing their keys. Who here hasn't lost their keys? So you start rationalizing and telling yourself stories of, ah, oh, I've had a rough day, I don't remember where my keys are. But then it starts getting a little bit more complicated than that. They stop initiating discussion. They start sitting quiet and they can't follow a conversation when there's lots of people in the room, or they might say something inappropriate and then sort of everybody looks at them and then they recover pretty fast. And at the early stages, it's really hard to know, is this a depression? Is this confusion, or what is it? And so people start putting pieces together, and you also have to remember that dementia is not something that you get confused and you're confused all the time. So people might wake up in the morning and they're really sharp, and then as the day goes by and they fatigue, they get tired, their brain gets tired, they might start showing more and more symptoms. Or if they had a really busy day the day before, the next day might be a little bit of a slower day. So it fluctuates throughout the day. We also know that if there's an infection in someone with dementia, it's going to increase. So if they have a urinary tract infection, or if there's constipation, or if there's dehydration, or if there's anything in the body organically, that might also have an impact. But it also cannot be dementia. So we know that if people have an imbalance in different endocrinological things in their body, they have a low B12, or if there are problems in different areas in their body, they can appear disorientated and confused. We know that if someone has an undiagnosed depression, they can appear as if they are more confused and more disorientated. We know that if people are not socializing, not getting out, so take an 85-year-old person who's sitting at home doing nothing all day, their children have moved away, their partner has passed away, and they just sort of sit at home all day, they're going to be disorientated to time and place. Is it Tuesday? Is it Wednesday? Is it the 24th of the month or the 26th of the month? They might be a little bit more confused. So often what happens is children start noticing things, or partners notice things. Then there's a whole period of making excuses for the person and rationalizing. And if there's a partner involved, often what happens is they will overcompensate. So they'll step in when someone says something inappropriate. So there's no gap to sort of feel that, that was different, that was strange. And children, because often adult children, they'll see snapshots. So one child will see dad really, really good, or see dad not really, really good, or see them on the weekend when they've had a lot of rest, or see them during the week. It can be quite confusing in the early stages to actually come up with a diagnosis. So is it important to have a diagnosis? Like, why would you want to go get a diagnosis of a terminal disease? Dementia is terminal, it's progressive, it's degenerative, there's no cure for it. We know that it's a one-way continuum. You can live with it for anywhere between 20 to 30 to 40 years. Now, the word suffering always comes up with dementia, and I want to encourage us to say living with dementia, because the shift from suffering is that the person suffers all the time, and that's not true. People with dementia live beautiful lives. The only difference is they live in the moment, and so they celebrate life in the moment. Yesterday might not have happened. Tomorrow is irrelevant, because time is something that they lose over time. And initially, also with dementia, they lose a short-term memory first. Last thing in, first thing out. So short-term memory starts going first, and then as the disease progresses, we notice that it starts eating into their long-term memory. And we'll go into that a little bit further later. So back to the question, is a diagnosis important? Just quick show of hands, who thinks a diagnosis is important? Put your hands up. And who thinks it's not important? Okay, interesting. There's no right or wrong answer. Okay, that's what it comes down to. It comes down to, is it important for you to confirm that your partner or father or parent or child has a disease? That's your own personal, there's no right or wrong. It's a personal preference. For some, it's devastating to get the diagnosis and they go home and they curl up and it actually induces a depression. And for some, it's really important to have a confirmation. I'm not going out of my mind. There's a reason that I'm forgetting. There's a reason that I can't remember where I've put my keys or what day it is. Or there's a reason why I'm feeling so down all the time and I can't collect my thoughts. Someone once said to me, it feels like I live in a cloud, that I have cotton wool in my head. And so for them to get a diagnosis, it was a confirmation and a validation to say, hold on a second, something is actually happening. So is it important to get a diagnosis? I don't know. But it's a question that goes back to the family to say, is it important for you as a family to then be able to figure out how you're going to live the next 20, 30 years and plan the family structure around that? So what do you do if you do see signs? Where do you go? Some of you might go to a GP, some of you might go to a neuropsychologist, some of you might decide to go to a geriatrician if you're over the age of 65. Sometimes the GP says, oh, I'm also forgetting, you know, it's fine, and they make excuses. So you say, you finally get your partner to go to the GP, they go to the GP and the GP dismisses it. You could go to a geriatrician, you can go to a psychogeriatrician, you can go to a psychiatrist, a neurologist, an endocrinologist, you can go to any specialist you want to make potentially a diagnosis. However, you can't expect the person that is experiencing the dementia to go and say, well, hey, this is what I'm experiencing, A, B, C, and D, because they don't remember. And so they walk in and they say, so why are you here? Well, I don't know. Nothing's wrong with me. I feel fine. And you have to remember, dementia is a disease of neck up. We're not talking about neck down. Many people with dementia are really healthy, and they're healthy for a really long time. But what happens is neck up, there's more happening up there. And so there needs to be a story around it. So either a partner or a child goes with the person living with dementia or suspected cognitive impairment to go and tell the stories. You know what, my mom's losing her car. She's very repetitive. She used to be an incredible baker, and now she makes awful cakes. Because all of those are signs. And all of those are symptoms. And often what happens is once a diagnosis happens, the family gets together saying, she was doing all these strange things. He was being strange. And it sort of makes the ticks of approval of all these things of years of thinking that there was a problem. And so you put a story together, and only through the story, then they do blood tests, and they might do PET scans and functional MRIs, and they cancel out that it's not a brain tumor, that it's not a vitamin deficiency, that it's not any other problem, and then they can make a diagnosis. Sometimes you'll get a diagnosis of just a dementia. Sometimes it'll be a clear diagnosis of an Alzheimer's, vascular dementia, Lewy body dementia. So what are the differences between the dementias? And is it important to know what type of dementia you have? Each one presents a little bit different. Tonight we don't have enough time to go into the differences, but each one does present a little bit different. For some, it's loss of language, which your language is on your left. That's why I'm doing this. Your language is on the left side of your brain. The rhythm of the way we speak is on the right, left, right. Language is on the left, rhythm is on the right. And so people lose language, and they might lose initially every 15th word, and then it'll be every 10th word, and then it'll be every 4th word, and then it becomes semantic, and they might speak in a fruit salad. With vascular dementia, they might not have word searching or repetitiveness, they might have time travel that they'll confuse of time of day, and they might be disorientated. With Lewy body dementia, there might be hallucinations, that they might see things in the evening. As they fatigue, they might see things that aren't really there. It also looks a bit Parkinsonian, so often what happens is with Lewy body's dementia, people get misdiagnosed with Parkinson's, and then only years later do they actually get a diagnosis of Lewy body's, and the truth be told, only by postmortem can you actually do a differential diagnosis by looking at their brain to see was it Parkinson's, was it Lewy body's. You also have Kosakoff syndrome. So anybody who's drinking more than 2 glasses of wine a day, you are at risk for alcohol-induced dementia. And it's a real thing. We're seeing people younger and younger that are getting dementia from alcohol. And it can be quite an aggressive dementia. So I guess I want to move on to choice and relevance and purpose. Because often people will get a diagnosis and society automatically puts the label of their suffering, and we need to exclude them. We need to take away their driver's license. We need to, you know, stop them from getting involved in communal things. They have to stop their work. They have to, you know, they can't bake anymore if they enjoy baking. They can't drive anymore. They can't participate. We try to talk about them without them, which is not something that we should be doing. As a society, when someone gets cancer, everybody brings them meals and they get therapy and rehab. If somebody gets a stroke, people are entitled to rehabilitation. They get occupational therapy and speech therapy and physiotherapy. But when someone gets a diagnosis of dementia, we don't teach them how to live with the disease. We tell them go suffer or go die with the disease. And one of the things as a society and as a community, we have to learn to reprogram our thinking that if someone gets a diagnosis of a cognitive impairment, we have a responsibility to teach them how to live well with the disease. And through OT and speech pathology and physiotherapy, people can learn to live well. How do I function in a home on my own? How do I stay as independent as possible for as long as possible? And unfortunately, families are not equipped because they don't have the knowledge. Nobody ever gives us a handbook to say, well, how am I going to live? And we try and do the best, and we go into this world of, oh, you should do this, and you should do this, and you should drink coconut oil, or coconut milk, or you should, you know, walk or have kale, or you should, and you should, and you should. And all of a sudden, the person's doing all these very bizarre things that they never did before, because you should. But instead of saying, well, what do you want to do? And having the conversation with the person with dementia and saying, this is a really tough diagnosis.
But who do you go to discuss that with? Who do you go to?
Who do you go to discuss what?
That, like who, for example, my mom's got frontal dementia. Who do I take her to discuss how she's going to live?
Well, I would encourage the conversation to happen between you and her. Because it's about teaching you to have that conversation because you're her trust person. You're her person that she trusts, and she looks at you and she sees someone familiar. If you took her to a stranger who she doesn't trust, the first thing that she would say is, what do you know about me? You don't even know me. And whether using the word dementia, which I encourage people to use because it's not a bad word, it's a disease. It's like using ears and eyes and nose. It's a disease, or cancer, or UTI, any part of our body. So having the discussion with them and normalizing it and humanizing it. Same way that we know that we're not getting out of here alive, okay? We're all dying. One day we all are going to die. That's going to happen to all of us, and we all have that in common. And we all have to be able to have discussions about saying, well, how do you want to die? What do you think of death? What's your end of life journey look like? And having those discussions, when someone gets a diagnosis of dementia, it's important to, first of all, validate this is a really difficult discussion for me to have. This is a really difficult diagnosis to live with. It's difficult for the person living with dementia, and it's also the person living with the person living with dementia. Because there's two people that are always diagnosed. There's the person that has the disease, and there's the person living with the person that has the disease. Because they're losing something as well. They're losing a person. And there's two losses happening. There's the own internal loss and the own validation of saying, I'm struggling with this disease. But the earlier you can have that conversation, the better. And unfortunately, people only think of having that conversation when it's too late. And the person can't have the conversation. By the time you're ready to have that conversation, it's really late. And so I encourage you, if you know someone, or if you don't know someone, or if one day you do know someone, encourage the conversation early on in the disease. Because when it's too late, you can't have that conversation. Community plays a really big role for people with dementia. And I don't necessarily mean only this community, which of course I'm an advocate of Jewish communities and from communities and villages, because it gives people purpose. You know, I used to work in an old age home, a nursing home in Jerusalem. And there was a man who had dementia, and every single day he'd come and he'd go and he'd take his sitter from the thing and he'd take his Kiddush cup, and every night was Friday night. Didn't matter. And he'd make Kiddush every Friday night. But it gave him purpose. And every day he'd go and get his Becher and he'd get his Siddur and he'd make a Kiddush. Now people say, oh, you should orientate him. He loved Friday night. Friday night was a really good time for him in his memory. And so when he would time travel in his mind and he'd go back to Friday night, that was a peaceful place. And his children would come and say, Dad, it's not Friday night, it's Tuesday. And they'd get so angry and they'd get upset. And finally I said to him, why do you care? It's Friday night for him. And Friday night in him, in his time travel, is a beautiful time. It's memories of sitting around with the kids at the table. It's memories of him and his wife sitting, you know, together. These are good times for him. So if he's time traveling, don't take him out of that time travel and bring him into your reality. Because your reality is he has dementia, he's living in a nursing home, and he's on his own. That's not a really great reality, is it? So it's about really about creating a certain level of purpose and relevance for him, but he had with his community, because he was accepted. He would go to shul, he'd go to shul 3 times a day, and he was greeted because he was a somebody. And sometimes when, you know, when we work in aged care, people will walk in and say, "Do you know who I am?" Because that's like, do you know who I was? Do you know that I ever had relevance? That I had purpose? And the most beautiful thing is when you walk into a shul, someone's gonna come up to you and say, "Hey, do you wanna sit here?" Someone's gonna greet you. When you walk into, whether it's a church or mosque, there's a sense of community. So community is very, very important for people that definitely are living with dementia. Younger onset versus older onset dementia. We sort of rationalize when someone has older onset dementia, they've lived a good life. They're 80, they're 90 years old, you know, they've lived a good life. When someone at the age of 40 gets diagnosed, they have a young family, they have a young partner, they haven't yet completed life. It can be devastating in both instances. Because when someone at the age of 80 thinks they're going to travel and retire and live life, and all of a sudden retirement looks a little bit different, and at 40 you're still building your career and you're still building up. So you're dealing with a young family versus older children. You're dealing with a partner, and sometimes in older age they don't have a partner. The symptoms are very, very different. At the age of 80, 85, you might be dealing with a frailer person. Not always. Sometimes you have very, very strong 85-year-olds. And with a 40-year-old, you're dealing with a very, very healthy person. Neck down. So humanizing dementia is very much the thing, my personal philosophy. It's about being able to have the conversation, not talk about them without them. You know, you'll be in a room and there'll be someone with dementia and you see people talking about them and they're sitting there. That's completely dehumanizing. As opposed to saying, "Are you following this conversation? Is it okay if I..." and ask permission from the person. And sometimes being able to include them in the discussion, and yeah, they might get angry. And yeah, they might not agree. And they might not follow the full conversation, but it's learning to have different types of conversations. The world of dementia is about living in the moment and creating cherished moments and not about creating new memories. It's about today was a really good day or today was a really awful day. That doesn't mean that tomorrow is going to be awful. It just means that today was pretty bad. It's about creating ripple effects that if we create beautiful moments in time, the feeling, the person will remember the feeling of that moment in time. They might not remember exactly what happened. The journey with dementia is complex and different. You can have 100 different people and each person will have the same type of dementia. They might all have Alzheimer's or frontal temporal dementia or vascular dementia, but it will present differently. Can there be aggression in dementia? Yes, but not always. Can there be agitation? Absolutely, but not always. Can there be paranoia? Absolutely, but not always. Can there be repetitiveness, memory loss, deterioration of mobility and thinking? Do they lose their intellect? No. And that's often what children or spouses will say to me, "Oh, but my husband's very, very intelligent." Dementia doesn't affect unintelligent people. And it doesn't take away their intelligence. They can be very intelligent all the way to the end. So the one thing I do want to leave you with, because I don't want to take up any more time, is learn to shift the conversation. Look at a way to include them in the conversation. Look to validate the person that's living with dementia and address the elephant in the room. They know that something is happening. And you might have the same conversation multiple times. So what? You might have to say it in different ways each time. You might have to write it down. You might think of creative solutions. Every person's journey is different. If you can have the conversation about the disease, what their wishes are, what they want, what they don't want, what's confronting about it, what's not confronting, very, very important to include that in that discussion. And learn to cherish moments, not to anticipate. We're always so worried about what's going to happen tomorrow, what's going to happen next week, what's going to happen. Right now, you're having a really good morning with that person. Thumbs up. Or right now, it's a really bad morning. That doesn't mean that tomorrow is going to be bad. So learning to live in the moment as opposed to anticipating what will happen in the future. Thank you.
We are going to have time for questions, so I'm sure lots of people want to ask questions. Thank you so much. That was very, very informative. As my son mentioned before, in our family, it's a little bit personal, this topic as well. My mother-in-law, unfortunately, lives with dementia, to use the right terminology. quite advanced dementia, unfortunately. But I'm just going to spend a little bit of time, just a few moments, to share with you just two perspectives, really, from a Jewish point of view. Maybe also following on from some of the things that you said, which I think are so important, about how we treat the people and so on. Of course, Tamara mentioned before that there's two people that get diagnosed with dementia, and that's the person themselves and people that live with him. And I'm focusing more, not so much on a partner, but more on parents. In other words, having parents that suffer from dementia. And I wanted to just touch on two almost opposite challenges. And the one is just to draw on one of the fundamental mitzvot that we have in the Torah, one of the Ten Commandments, of course. We read about it a couple of weeks ago on the Parsha of the Week. And that is the mitzvah of kibud av va'em, honoring parents. And I want to just expand on this for a couple of moments, because actually it's quite a misunderstood mitzvah. And I say that because sometimes people think that kibud av va'em, honoring parents, the way it's written in the Torah, is a mitzvah given to small children. And the reason that small children with young parents who are parenting, the reason people think that is because that's what we always got told as kids. It was a good parenting tool. You have to listen to me because it's in the Torah. And remember, you learned it in school. It's in the Parsha. You know, can you tell me the Ten Commandments? Yes, one of them is listen to parents. Oh, good boy, good girl. Right? So my parents use it with me. I use it with my parents. And I'm sure my kids are using it with my grandkids as well. And that's okay. It's a nice strategy. But in fact, it's actually the other way around. It's not actually true. Many, many commentaries, many halakhic authorities actually talk about kibud av va'em, the mitzvah of honoring parents, specifically when parents are older. That's when the mitzvah actually mainly applies, because number one, the definition of the mitzvah is actually not to listen to them when they tell you what to do. It's actually to care for them. It's to respect them, it's to love them, and to help them. That's actually what the mitzvah is. That's a very, very fundamental moral and value, a fundamental Jewish value, a universal value, but of course a Torah value as well. Now, the point that I wanted to make is this. There's a famous commentator called the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch is a book that goes through all the mitzvot of the Torah. And when it comes to kibud av va'em, honoring parents, he makes the following point. With every mitzvah, he tries to give some meaning, some rationale to the mitzvah, or some purpose of the mitzvah. And he says that when it comes to kibud av va'em, essentially, the mitzvah is about gratitude. And he said it's about showing gratitude and being grateful to those people who ultimately are responsible for you being in the world. And he says that ultimately this is a pathway for gratitude in general, and it's a pathway to be grateful to God who created us. So God gave us the mitzvah of being grateful to those parents who brought us into the world and brought us up and cared for us, and ultimately through that being grateful to the ultimate creator for bringing us into the world. But here's the point that I wanted to make. Gratitude is something which is often misunderstood. Who benefits from gratitude? So of course, when I'm grateful to someone for doing something for me, that person is affected positively. Everyone likes to get good feedback. If you do something really nice for someone, and they give you feedback, and they say thank you, or they give you a card, or they go out of their way to mention you and so on, that's very touching, and it always makes the person who did the good deed, or the person who gave you the kindness, strengthens them and makes them feel good. But in fact, it's not only that. In fact, one of the primary purposes of gratitude is for the person showing gratitude. And we learn this from a very interesting, story in the Torah, where God brings the 10 plagues to the Egyptians. And the first one is blood, and it happened through Moses. He wanted Moses to take his stick and to smite the Nile River. And then the water was going to turn into blood. And God says to Moses, don't smite the river, let your brother do it. Why not? Because you need to show gratitude to the river, because when you were a baby, you were saved by your mother putting you in the reeds of the river. And therefore, the river protected you, so you can't hit it. Now, the last time I checked, rivers don't have feelings, and they don't need the gratitude. But it's not the point. The point is that we, as people who grow and develop as human beings, and become sensitive people, and refine our character, and show models of good behavior to other people, we need to learn gratitude. The reason I say this is because one of the challenges of dementia is that pain sometimes of in advanced dementia, and the pain of taking care of someone, showing them dignity, coming to them as your as their child, and they don't recognize you, and they don't know who you are. And that's, I know that for my wife's case, that's a very, very painful thing. That's the stage where it's at. And that's a very difficult thing. So I think it's really important to understand that showing that gratitude, giving someone dignity, has just as much to do with us showing the dignity and showing the appreciation than it does with the person understanding that the appreciation is given. And there's no better opportunity of real kindness when someone is at the stage where perhaps they don't recognize you, or they're confused, they don't know who you are. But the ability to give unconditionally, the ability to love, the ability to be kind, the ability to care for someone, even though they don't even know why it's upon you necessarily to care for them, is an amazing moral and value. Also, it's also an amazing example for our children and perhaps our grandchildren, for them to see what real respect means and what real giving means and what real unconditional giving means. So I just wanted to mention that because I think that's sometimes an aspect of very real thought process and challenge that goes in, like that, and that kindness is about the person, it's not about us. It's about doing what is right, it's about doing what is good for us as people, it's about doing what is beneficial for us, showing examples of kindness. And I think that follows on from what Tamara said about, it includes everything, not just caring for the person, but showing the person dignity and treating the person as a human being, no matter how advanced that dementia was, by looking for opportunities for them to feel good, for them to be part of an experience that they love, that they feel good, that they feel valued, even if it's just in that moment, as you mentioned before. And yes, even though for a person who doesn't live with dementia, I would say making kiddush every Friday night is not a good idea, but for that person, it's an absolutely good idea. It's a great idea on all levels, any halachic level. It's such a good... And that's also part of caring for someone. Part of is knowing what they need, not what is universally accepted. Obviously, you go to an old age home and someone's making kiddush every night. If it was my friend who's making kiddush every night who doesn't live with dementia, I would say, you know, you really need to do something else on a Tuesday night, not making kiddush, right? And that's kind of not the thing we do as Jews, but this kiddush is reserved for once a night. But if it's what they need in terms of their advanced dementia, if that's what makes them have dignity or feel valued, it's a great idea. I love that. And the other thing I want to touch on is the following, is the issue of guilt. And again, we're talking about the people who live with people with dementia. Because the flip side of this is, when people are at the stage where they are riddled with guilt because they're not sure if they're being the right or the best son or the best daughter. And therefore, often what happens is, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but often what happens is people tend to take upon themselves things that they don't know how to do, that they can't cope with, or they don't have the expertise to do, all because they don't want to be seen by themselves or by their peers, perhaps, as someone who's not being a good child or a good partner. And that's a problem, because guilt is, you know, a little bit of guilt is a good thing, and when we're Jewish, we always have guilt. But in this case, it's a really important thing to actually consider. It's not about me. And this is true, by the way, of all giving. You know, I always say this, people who've heard me before would know, I always talk about this. Like when you visit someone who's sick in hospital, for example, because it's the right thing to do and it's a mitzvah, but to visit someone who's unwell, right? So sometimes people do that, but they forget that they're doing it for the person who is sick. They're not doing it for themselves to feel good. And therefore, they might stay there for an hour and a half and the person is tired, they need to go to sleep, right? And they're undermining and they've done more harm than good. Giving is something we do. The definition of giving and caring is caring and giving for what the person needs, not what makes me feel good. And therefore, sometimes we have to talk to a professional, sometimes we have to talk to the person, but if it's really hard, I might need to talk to a mentor or a rabbi or a spiritual coach or someone who just knows what they're doing and find out what is the right thing for me, what's better for the person. Maybe it's something that I can't take upon myself, maybe it's something I need to get help for, or I need to get a caregiver, or I need to get other facilities or other professionals to intervene, to do things that they can do better for the person, that will be more beneficial for the person, better than I can do it. And that's something, a discussion we need to have with ourselves, with the person, when it's possible to do that, if it's not too late, and with people that can help us, that we can confide in or we can trust. Because that guilt can sometimes be destructive. So those two opposite things, on the one hand, no matter where, at what stage the person is, the greatness of being able to care and give them dignity, even though they might not know who you are even, and they might not know even why you're giving it, is unbelievably important for ourselves, for the moral stance and for showing an example. The flip side of that is sometimes there's things that we just can't do and that guilt can get in the way and actually be destructive, and we need to know what's best for the person rather than what's best for me to make me feel good. Those are just some thoughts, and I want to just thank Tamar again for coming. It's very, very informative, and in fact explains a lot of things along the journey which perhaps I didn't understand before. And over to Rabbi Levi. First, a big thank you to Rabbi Levi for organizing this event. He's going to take us from here on with a couple of questions and open it to you, and thanks for coming.
Okay. Thank you all so much. What I'm going to do is I'm actually going to pose a question to each of you and ask you just to elaborate on something, and then we'll open it up to all of you because I'm sure there are many questions. So just first of all, Tamar, I'm sure you've had experience with this. If someone has a parent that has dementia and they have children as well, so in other words, there's grandchildren, and so I, as a grandchild, knew my grandmother before she had dementia. Let's say you have young grandchildren who didn't know them. Is there a point for the grandchildren and for the grandparent in developing a relationship? And would you see it as damaging almost to the grandchildren if every week when they come, they're not recognized by their own grandparent? Like, how would you suggest someone would deal with such a problem?
So yes, we do see lots of that. The big thing for children are a wonderful medicine for people with dementia, because children don't challenge. They don't say, "Mom, what'd you do today?" Because most daughters or sons will walk into a room and ask their parent with dementia what they do today, and they have memory loss. It's like asking a blind person, "Tell me about that painting. What do you see?" And so children don't do that. Children walk in, and there's a certain level of unconditional love and engagement. And I think there's two sides of every relationship. There's the person living with dementia that they still feel purposeful in being the grandparent. But there's also the element of the grandchild learning, you can either say chesed, or learning about the fact that not everybody is perfect in the world. And yeah, granny or saba or safta or bubby zaidi, they have a bit of memory loss. And there's some great books out there to explain to children that you might have to introduce yourself every single time you come. But that's the part where we teach people compassion, and we role model compassion to our grandchildren. And what I would encourage a grandchild to do when they're visiting is bring something to do. Bring a photo album, bring a book, bring a something, so it's not sitting and trying to have a conversation, but it's actually focusing on something and then having a common experience that the child can have fun, the person with dementia, is living with dementia, can enjoy the experience, and then they walk away. They both had very different experiences, but it's been a positive, cherished moment.
Okay, very good. And just a question to my father, and then we'll open up to all of you. Sort of in a more spiritual perspective. So when you see someone suffering from dementia and then they're...
Living with dementia.
I have to reshape my... Living with dementia. Sort of from a spiritual perspective, how do you find purpose in that? In other words, you see someone living for 10, 20 years, sometimes in very, very severe, and they don't remember anything, and they can't remember... If you could provide some sort of spiritual... As hard as it is to accept it emotionally, but there has to be some sort of spiritual perspective to it, as what's the purpose of that?
That's a great question. So I think it depends, obviously, on what stage they are. I mean, I think what Tamar was explaining before, that when there's any level of awareness or consciousness, there's always purpose to be given, there's always value, but I think it goes, obviously, deeper, and it's not really for this discussion, but it's a big discussion, and it goes to the heart. And I think that's why the caring for someone and giving dignity to someone, even with very advanced dementia, goes to the very heart of the Jewish view of life. And the Jewish view on life, obviously, as we know, is that life, just as it is, without functionality, without achievement, without accomplishing anything, has an inherent and intrinsic and infinite value. The very fact that there's a body and a soul that lives together, we might not appreciate what the value is, we might not know, but that's why in halakha, in Jewish law, where you can break Shabbos to save someone's life, you can break Shabbos for someone who's got very, very advanced dementia, and they might even have only a few hours to live, and you can break Shabbos to prolong your life, because life has an infinite sanctity. But just to add one little dimension to it, and it goes back to the concept of unconditional love. They might not be able to function, they might not be able to communicate with you and to love you, but you can love them. And that might be their purpose. Mm-hmm. Their purpose might be you developing compassion, you developing kindness, you developing an example for your children and your grandchildren. So that's perhaps just one concept. But apart from that, in the Jewish view, it's actually built down to something very simple. There's inherent infinite sanctity of all life.
Okay, very good. Okay. Yes, please, go ahead.
Hello, thank you for a beautiful presentation. I learned a lot. I work in aged care, and I'm coming across a lot of this, where how is life permissible when the dementia residents that I work with say, I'm waiting for my mother or my father, or my friend's coming to see me and I want to go out, and things like that. So how do you address, are you allowed to lie, not lie? How do you?
So I'm going to let the non-halachic side.
Because if you say they live in the moment, you have to see it from their perspective.
So there's something called a therapeutic fib, and there's something called time travel. So people with dementia in the later stages, they time travel. So time travel can be that literally comes sundown, sunset, and all of a sudden the kids are waiting, I need to go home to make dinner. And they're distressed by it. And you can see an elderly woman in her 90s wanting to go home and make dinner for her children. And you think, you have two options at that point. You can either say, your children are in their 70s, nobody's waiting for you, no one needs you to cook dinner, just come sit down and let's do a puzzle. Or you can say, tell me about your children. What would you like to make them for dinner? And you go into their world, and all of a sudden you validate that anxiety. And you spend some time in that world, and there's always going to be a window of opportunity for you to then divert and go into a different space. But I wouldn't pull them out for the sake of your own peace of mind. Well, I can't lie to them, that's not what's going on here. And then we tell ourselves all these rational stories, but go into their reality, into their world, and there's comfort there. And then you can either move on or stay in that world. And it happens in lots of different ways. They want to go home, they want to go out, they need to go find their car. So, you know what? Let's go find your car. And you might go for another hour walk looking for their car. That's much better than trying to say, you don't have a car, you stopped driving 20 years ago, and getting into this ping pong tassel. And kids really, they can get quite agitated in that space.
It's very difficult when they're bashing the door.
Oh, absolutely. And I would open the door. I'm all for opening the door and put your runners on and have a phone with you and make sure you're going to go. And sometimes it's going to be 2-3 hours. But you don't get between a person and the door. I'm just conscious that there's someone there and will come to you in 1 minute. Yes, in the back?
Yes. I've got two questions. First of all, the talk is very much from the outside looking in, from the perspective of a carer or a relation. Is there any research being done with these patients before the dementia is too advanced? From the inside looking out. In other words, the patient's fears, their emotions, their joys, what they like, what they dislike.
Absolutely.
You know, what it's like being in that position rather than the carer who has somebody that they know that has dementia. And the second thing is many preventative prescriptives are either spoken or written about. How many of these have been scientifically proven or medically proven, and how many of them are just myths? Like, you know, you should do crosswords and Sudoku, and you must exercise, and you must drink so much water. How much of this is actually proven?
So do I have time for a quick story?
Yeah, please.
So I'm at a conference about, I think it's 8 years ago, and there's about 3,000 people in the audience, and the topic is sexuality. And on the stage, they have a director of care, a doctor, a priest, they had the moderator, and they had, I don't know who else. There was about 10 people on the stage. And they're talking about this topic, and this woman gets up from the audience and says, stop talking about us without us. You know, everybody gets a bit awkward and whatever, and someone goes up to her and talks to her, and she sits down. The next session I went to was on younger onset dementia, and this lady gets up. And she was diagnosed at the age of 49. And at that point, she was 64. And her name is Kate Swaffer, and she's a big advocate about people's journeys through dementia. And there's a lot of research being done on people's experience and how they feel. Her term that she actually had it copyrighted was prescribed disengagement. When someone gets a diagnosis, they're prescribed to go home and die and suffer with dementia. And she's all about in disability, and when people get a stroke or a Parkinson's, they're taught how to live with the disease and their feelings and emotions. And the day before the diagnosis, they were driving, drove a car, held jobs, ran a household, and all of a sudden when they get the diagnosis, that's supposed to stop. So there's a lot of research being done and a lot more advocacy for the person living with the disease. So absolutely. Your second question, which I forgot, which is ironic, but just remind me what the second question was.
What's preventative?
Preventative. So there's a lot of research being done over the last 25 years. A lot of research. Unfortunately, nothing yet has become proven to be, there's medication that slows it down but doesn't stop it. The Mediterranean diet, there was a lot of hope that that was going to be preventive. So coconut oil, eating non-processed food, less sugar, exercising. The concept of what's good for your heart is good for your brain. So socializing, doing things that connect you, whether it's spiritually, physically, things that are good for your heart in terms of cardiologically, so eating foods that are healthy, all those are positive things. Being needed, so having a purpose, getting you up in the morning, being relevant, staying involved, doing Sudokus, learning a new language, music is like a light bulb for the brain. So there's a lot of good stuff, but there's no cure yet. Yes.
Thanks for coming tonight, Tamara, and it's been interesting hearing your tools of dealing with people with dementia. I work with Jewish Care Aged Care Services, and I've dealt with people, as other Jewish care workers have, from violent down to passive. And mentally, just for the benefit of others, when I've done the dementia thing, but I don't really remember it. Just some aspects of it have helped me. I've got a certificate, but it doesn't make me anywhere near as educated as yourself. And your knowledge is important to get out in the community so people can work through and find aspects to help them deal with people and dementia. But what I do as a mental thing before I engage with someone with dementia is I always say to myself, and this might go against your brain in a wet sense, I say, I can't change them, but I can change myself. So when I go in to greet them and whatnot, I'm aware of their memory loss and other aspects, and I work around those things. But going in, I just say, I know I can't change you at your various stages of dementia, but I can change myself to address it. So that second person that you were talking about, and Rabbi Gerari mentioned about respect and that aspect to it. I mean, yeah, you, the tools that you're talking about are really good. You know?
And that's a perfect approach because you can adapt yourself, and that's the only thing you can change is your attitude and your approach.
I wish they knew what the cause of dementia was. I don't know. That would really be a big
no
change.
No surprise.
I mean, any ideas? Have you got any ideas?
I don't know.
No comment.
We have a question here. Let's try as much as possible.
Has there been any research that is to ethnic groups in the world who are more predisposed to getting it or not getting it? For example, are people in Mexico, ethnic Mexicans, predisposed to getting it or are they safe as a general group?
So that's a really good question.
Ashkenazi Jews, for example.
Everything's Ashkenazi Jews. Always to blame. Our gene pool is dead. So there is a lot of research on ethnic groups, and I'm not 100% familiar with them. So, but it's worth researching.
We have a question over here.
Is it hereditary? 1%
of dementias are hereditary. Usually they come with another diagnosis. So we know that someone who's diagnosed with FTD and motor neuron disease, sometimes that can be hereditary. There are different blood tests that you can test the apogene for different types of Alzheimer's, but it's not common for it to be hereditary.
The 1% that is hereditary, is it the same type of dementia or just
different types?
Different types.
Hmm. Anybody else? Yes. Go ahead.
Can you just touch a little bit on Alzheimer's, because that's very commonly used, and how that is a subset and how that works, please?
So how it works in terms of where, how does it present?
Yeah.
Okay, so typically with Alzheimer's early stages, you'll see repetitiveness. So someone might say, what time is it? And then a minute later, what time is it? What time is it? And they'll say, I told you already 5 times, it's 10 o'clock. And you usually see that. Like, oh, okay, that's fine. And then, you know, they might not be repetitive for a couple more days. They might start, where's my, what is it? And it's on their tip, so it's word searching. So you might find word searching. Now we all get stuck on words. We all, I just saw so-and-so at the Westfield, but what's their name? I can't remember that. And we all do that. So we think, oh my gosh, I have dementia. You don't have dementia, okay? But we all do word searching. So repetitiveness, disorientation. All of a sudden they're becoming a bit disorientated to time and place. So you might say, we're going out in 10 minutes, but all of a sudden 10 minutes go by and they're back in bed sleeping. You say, but I told you we were going out 10 minutes ago, but they don't remember. So there's this time, disorientation to time and place. They might be, the things that they were interested in, they might become disinterested in. So it looks like an apathy. All of a sudden they're not initiating discussion or they're not following the discussion. So all of these things, you know, are also, that happen to all of us. We all have days where we don't feel like making conversation or we don't remember the neighbor, what's that person's name? I can't remember. And where did I put my, oh, what is this called? I forgot what this is, oh, it's a key. And the more intelligent you are, the more you can mask it. But eventually, the masking, it all of a sudden becomes a little bit more pronounced. That all of a sudden, you wouldn't walk around with dirty clothing, and all of a sudden, you're happy to walk around with dirty clothing. And your spouse might say to you, hey, your shirt's dirty, go change. You're like, no, it's fine. And you think, that's a bit strange. And then you say, you know, did you shower? Because you smell a bit. Of course I showered. And you know that they haven't showered. And all of a sudden you're starting to notice things and gaps that they're not all the time, there's some of the time. You're a bit worried about it. And so that's when you encourage to say, you know what, go get tested. And you get a baseline. Because sometimes you'll see the symptoms way before you get a diagnosis. Because it might take a year or two till the deterioration actually becomes functional. So dementia has to be diagnosed when it from the brain functioning bodily things as well.
You have a question over there.
So you spoke about people being in denial or the doctor poo-pooing things and saying, everyone's forgetful. How do you, for a person who doesn't really want to know or is in denial, how do you explain to them or encourage them to get tested? So I'm completely ignorant. What are the steps what is diagnosis? What kind of testing is done?
So which question would you like me to answer?
Okay. Start with that one. What is that? You go to the GP and they say,
you have to come with a story. You can't just say, let's say your spouse has dementia and you say, Bob, go to the GP. You're getting dementia. And Bob goes to the GP and says, nothing's wrong with me, my wife sent me. That's not going to work. So if you want a diagnosis, you have to go and say, Dr. Smith, I'm really concerned about my husband, Bob. And he says, why? It's because Bob, are you happy for me to share what's going on? And Bob says, yeah, I'm happy for you to share. And you're including him in the conversation. You're saying, Dr. Smith, I'm really concerned because I'm noticing A, B, C, and D. Can you please send us for testing? So if Dr. Smith says, you know what, we're all forgetful, you are the advocate at that point. You do not take no for an answer. And you say, no, I'd like to be tested. I'd like my husband to go for testing. And if your husband's resistant, you might say, you know what, let's both go for testing. You know what, we're at that age, let's both go for testing. And it takes the limelight off him, and it becomes both of you. And you go for, it could be a neuropsych testing, which it's testing, retrieval, and sequencing, and executive function. And it's lots of question of book, apple, table, spell world backwards, subtract 100, 7 from 100, blah, blah, blah. And then they memorize the test, by the way. So you can say, people will come with dementia and say, oh, they're going to ask me, 100 minus 7 is 93, blah, blah, blah. And I don't even know that now, so I don't have dementia, I still don't know maths. But the point being is that they'll do neurological testing, they might send you for a blood test, they might send you for an MRI, they might send you, and because they want to rule out that it's not a brain tumor and that there isn't a bleed on the brain, there isn't some endocrinological reason that's happening. And then over time, you start getting closer and closer to the diagnosis. But you don't go in and they take your pulse and you know you have Alzheimer's.
Sorry, there's a facility that the daughter's actually using. It's called the Brain and Mind Institute. She's involved with the University of Sydney.
Yeah.
And she does all the testing and so on as you're speaking about.
Fabulous institution.
All right. Thank you all so much for coming. Sorry. Yes. Final question.
Maybe unusual, but can sometimes depression or anxiety present as a kind of dementia or Alzheimer's? Like, for instance, you're starting to realize that, okay, you forget names, or you know, to get older, you forget names, or maybe you forgot where you left the car, but then it happens a bit more often, and then you start to think, well, and you rely on your spouse to help you answer the question. So you say, so today we went for lunch. Where did we go for lunch? And then they answer, and then you say, and we had, and I had, what did I have for lunch? And not even thinking what he's had for lunch, he's more focusing on saying, getting the support from his spouse who answers the question. Now, I'm thinking a lot of it is, he's more anxious, his anxiety is overclouding what he's even trying to say.
So the person anxiety can mask dementia, the dementia can mask depression anxiety, but they do present semi-differently.
Right.
So there might be common symptoms like apathy or repetitiveness or disinterest or lots of different symptoms, but there are certain symptoms that you won't have in depression anxiety that you will have in dementia and vice versa. But definitely sometimes a severe depression anxiety can present and it looks like a dementia.
Right. Okay.
All right, thank you all so much for coming, and thank you so much to Tamar Krebs for coming. Thank you.